Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Eternals and Spencer, starting with Eternals, which is the latest in the whole superhero juggernaut of seemingly endless movies. And I will want to start off by saying I went in thinking, oh my God, not another one. I mean, how much more is there to say? And I also did not read anything about it going into it because I just wanted it to, you know, make it on its own merits. Now, I have seen, I think, everything in the Marvel Universe. So I sort of have a sketchy idea of, you know, the history of everything and, you know, the other movies, how they're supposed to come into play. But I didn't think that really mattered in this movie tremendously. What I did really find myself surprised by was how much I enjoyed something that's really just a memory from my past, which was getting my hands on as a young age, this book about Roman and Greek gods. And it had these wonderful tipped in color drawings of these, you know, like Medusa with the snakes and stuff like that, Mercury, you know, all of these really superheroes, you know, for the time, because I was too young to really understand the comic book world that was waiting out there in terms of the Marvel Universe. I mean, my exposure to comic books was, you know, the ones for little kids, Little Lulu, and then as we got older, just the Archie comics. This whole idea of a Marvel Universe was something that's never, I didn't discover that until I was an adult. But watching this movie, I suddenly remembered the way that world opened up in that book of these ancient myths. And it captured me for the duration of the movie. I was completely rapt, completely took me by surprise. Now I saw this in 3D, which I really recommend because the special effects are just not to be believed. And having seen this so soon after seeing Dune, I thought, see, this is what I was expecting Dune to be like, something that drew you in and dazzled you, and also gave you these callbacks to things you already understood and had forgotten that you loved. So Mike, what was your initial take?
Well, in terms of things that pull us into Greek mythology, I'm thinking back to, you know, when I read a book by Edith Hamilton, the great scholar, where she explains and tells or retells the ancient Greek myths. And as with Marie's anecdote, just, you know, from a young age, as a kid and early teens, just being pulled into the mythology, just mesmerized by it, and mentally having photographs of what the gods would have looked like and how they would have interacted. Now, this film overtly plays off of that. There are 10 so-called Eternals. And the jokey quality is they have names and attributes loosely drawn from the Greek pantheon. So there will be a one of them named Athena, and somebody else Icarus, somebody else Circe. You know, again, the spellings and all are a bit different, but the moment you see the word or hear it, you start thinking about what the Greek equivalents would have been. But let me cut to the chase in the sense that although I could appreciate drawing on ancient mythology that way, Marie and I are on opposite screens, if you will, opposite viewpoints here, because I didn't like this film at all, not a bit. To me, it just seemed like a really blunt, like bludgeoning example of Marvel building a new franchise. The film we have here, Eternals, again, nowadays, the norm for a superhero movie has got to be about 2.5 hours. So this one's 157 minutes. It's coming in that range. And to me, it was just overstuffed with characters, superhero characters, 10 principal Eternals, if you will, plus the deviants they're fighting, plus you name it, and just on and on. And it's a storyline where a lot of it is sort of what I call at the meet and greet level, like these superheroes who haven't met for a while. They've been on Earth for about 7,000 years. And there's some jokes about that. Well, you know, yeah, I dated him once. Well, how long did it last? Oh, only 5,000 years. You know, there's some jokey references that way. But where they're sort of like regrouping, reteaming, like, okay, we're ready to take on this new Marvel franchise. But where the film lost me was several fold. One was just simply how blatant it was in trying to build a new franchise, a new empire of characters and storylines. But I keep using the word overstuffed. It's all piled into this movie. There are so many characters, so many storylines, and a lot of the attention amounts to like flashbacks. And some of them just struck me as either pointless or redundant. Like the film, if you blink, the film is in ancient Babylon, and maybe it's there for 5 minutes, and then it goes somewhere else for 10 minutes. So all around the world, different places, different historical epochs, And I can sort of see thematically why it would do that. But after a while, it was unnecessary. It was just like an excuse to give you somebody dressed up in a warrior outfit and, you know, some big fight taking place way back when, and then it would skip somewhere else. But a lot of that flashback material was meant to sort of fill us in on who they are, who they were, and so on. And it gets cluttered that way. And that tends to slow down the momentum of it. And the film just seems overly busy. Even by superhero movie standards, I think it's over busy. And it just gets too hectic. And after a while, it's just a barrage of characters, storylines, jumping around in time, plenty of explosions, plenty of fights, and a lot of what we could call solar energy, if you will, people, whether through their eyes, their hands, whatever, have beams of light, and they're fighting other people. And I thought, oh my goodness, how much more of this will we have? And I realized, well, a few hours worth at least. So that was like, well, if I could put that under a single heading, it would be, you know, that's one major disappointment in terms of what all is stuffed into an overstuffed movie. The second major disappointment for me was that the director of the film, Chloe Zhao, she is, you know, an interesting director. Up to this point, mainly of really small narrative features, character studies, Nomadland, The Rider, films we've talked about actually on our program before. And on the one hand, it's admirable that a director will stretch, that this particular director who's done these small films goes to a big franchise film. And I don't think pulls it off. I think she's sort of lost in it, but she does bring some sense of character and nuance and encouraging actors to actually act. I'll give the film credit for that. But what ultimately is so disappointing for me is the fact that this is a director, I want to see her future projects and hopefully things more personal, more interesting than this particular film. I don't want to be crass and say she just did it for a big paycheck, but what happens is sometimes really promising, really gifted younger filmmakers like this one get an invitation to do a superhero movie. And how can you say no? It's not just a big paycheck. It puts you on a different platform. But whether they're selling or selling out, we could debate back and forth. But the fact that careers sort of get co-opted or hijacked, and rather than seeing more interesting, smaller pictures by her, we get this big picture that I think any number of other directors could have messed up in the way she messed it up.
I will agree with you on some aspects of what you had to say. And for one thing, I always think it's a mistake, unless you really have a reason for it, for a runtime to go over 2 hours, especially when you factor in all the previews you sit through and then waiting till the very end to see if there's an Easter egg. And by the way, there is. There are two Easter eggs, one after, you know, the teaser credits, but you have to stay to the bitter end to get that last one. And asking people to sit for 3 hours for that, you know, it really better pay off. That being said, I'll also agree, this is a very busy movie and there's a lot going on, Mike. You absolutely make a fair point there. But I didn't mind the shameless, you know, pandering for a new audience to take off into this side street. What I did kind of like was the way it made historical sense. It made itself make historical sense, where, you know, things that had happened in history ended up being part of the story, and things that happened in the Marvel world, like Thanos and what he did in those movies, ended up being part of their lore and what they talked about, as if, you know, this is, of course, how the world is and what has happened. There's a character in there because, you know, anytime you're going to get a squad of people to go out and save the world, you always have the one guy who's, you know, technically astute, you know, he's always the safecracker guy, or the computer hacker guy. Anyway, this guy has been parsing out technology to humans throughout the years to help us evolve. That's part of the story. And at one point, when after World War II in Hiroshima, this Eternal loses faith in humanity. Just, you know, these people aren't worth saving. There's so many of these moments where it's like, well, if this is how it was, this is what they would have thought through different points of time. I loved revisiting these characters at these moments of ethical dilemma. And there's several ethical dilemmas that come up within their world. You know, they've been created by a being. They're part of his creation. There's other creatures. And the dilemma, one of them is, do you trust that you're part of a bigger picture you can't see the entirety of and stay the course? Or do you break away because what you see is happening is, in your mind and your limited understanding, immoral? And I enjoyed the way they played off of those conundrums, which is why I thought all the flashbacks kind of worked. It just filled in the motivation for each of these people, lays the groundwork for some really funny moments, especially with the character playing Kingo, who has been living out some of his existence as a Bollywood superstar, and the human being, his valet, he takes with him on this journey. Some of their jokes, the whole audience I was in the movie theater with laughed their heads off. So I thought it had a nice mixture of pathos, big picture questions about the meaning of life, wonderful action sequences, and humor. Did any of that work for you, Mike?
The short answer is no.
Okay. All right. We're just going to agree to disagree.
No, Marie, I'm partly joking there. There were some bits that were funny, like the one superhero who has been working in Bollywood films. You really love those films, and I appreciate them too. And I like the way this film evoked the Bollywood ethos, if you will, of musical production numbers and what it is to be a movie star in the Indian film industry. And actually, in my world cinema class now, we're about to talk about Indian film, so I'm thinking about it as we're talking right now. And so I could appreciate all that. And I love the fact that I did actually love the fact they had this human sidekick who was there literally as like the proverbial comic sidekick, right? This guy has so many funny lines, and the audience did laugh. And even though there's so much about the film I didn't like, there were elements of mythology, and there certainly were some elements of humor in it, and some of the characterizations, and certainly there's some good actors in this. So begrudgingly, I'm yielding not a lot of ground at the moment, Marie, but a little bit of ground. It's like a tug of war here with the rope. And you're pulling me a little bit more to your side, but you still got to convince me some more.
Well, I will say this. I sat down kind of cynical. I mean, I didn't know anything about the movie. I just knew it had a really long runtime. And so I have no expectations. And within the first 5 minutes, and of course, this is also in 3D, a giant sea monster rises up and bites, you know, kills somebody, just eats them. Really took me aback. I just wasn't expecting. I was, you know, expecting more buildup. So I thought it just absolutely grabs you by the lapels from the very beginning and never let up. And maybe because it was in 3D, I just thought it was a thrill ride. And every time they would bring in a character like the person evoking Mercury, you know, Mercury had wings and could fly very fast. This character gets to zip back and forth in these ways that to me was just so much fun to watch. I also enjoyed the idea of the character who plays Sprite being kind of a Tinkerbell metaphor, how Tinkerbell, you know, she was a fairy. She wasn't a person. And she was, you know, enamored of Peter Pan and all he stood for, but was never going to be able to transcend the difference between them. So they kind of even get a little bit of, why did my creator make me like this? What was the point? And would I give it all up, all of my superpowers, to be human, to be a human being with a fleeting lifespan? Just, I know it does try to pack a lot of things in. Before I get to give it back to you to respond to that, I wanted to make sure I said my take on Chloe Zhao doing this movie was, I loved the writer, and we've talked about Nomadland. What I kind of thought about this was, here's this young woman who's in Hollywood getting these opportunities. And this is one where she gets to say, yeah, I can do a big blockbuster movie. I can make it look cool. I can do a variety of things. I'm not just waiting for the artistic opportunity. I can do blockbuster. I can do mainstream. I can make money for the studio. And the next thing I do might be completely off in another direction, but I can do it all.
You know, Marie, I really ardently agree with you that I'm hoping that turns out to be the case. That, you know, because she made these really small independent films and she's an interesting director and you want to see what she'll do next. My fear was that, as can sometimes happen, she would be, as I say, co-opted by or selling out to. And then, you know, in other words, like if you've directed a big superhero movie, what if they then invite you to direct its sequel? We know there'll be more of these, right? And that's where you get sort of swept up and you just become a quote unquote commercial director with a little more artistic patina than most. But what I'm hoping for is exactly what Marie said. And all you know, joking aside here, I really ardently do hope that this film is like a calling card for her. She's in Hollywood. She has small films that have been noticed and her name recognition is getting up there. And so this film already, Eternals, you know, big box office hit, critically kind of mixed reviews, but mixed to positive, I would say, or at least mixed. But Marie, to your core point, which I really agree with, if you can make really small films like she has, and you can make a film like this that really delivers at the box office and delivers with many viewers like yourself, honestly, you know, the people who really love this film, that gives her the power that now when she looks ahead, she can do what she wants. If she wants to do a small picture next, she'll get the funding for it, right? If she wants to do another blockbuster, okay, fine. She has a long career ahead of her. It's not for us to dictate how it should proceed. It's just my ardent hope, as I keep saying, that she goes on to make more quirky, idiosyncratic, personal films. You know what I'm getting at, Marie? That she mm-hmm. would have the liberty, the flexibility. I think that's what you're getting at, that she could go from one to the other, and why not? She's got the skill set, if you will.
Yeah, I think you summed that up beautifully. Did want to mention that for Game of Thrones people, you do get to see Kit Harington again. And, you know, he sort of fits into this world because it Game of Thrones kinds of fits into this world in its own, you know, way of hierarchies and secret worlds and fighting bad guys. Before we move on to the next movie, I did want to get your take on how you thought Angelina Jolie did in this. I will say she looks absolutely incredible. I liked her more than I thought I would. What did you think?
You know, Marie, I had a very mixed response to her. She plays the character, Angelina Jolie plays the character Athena, essentially Athena. So when you think of that, about strong women, in mythology, she's like the proverbial strong woman, right? And she's a warrior and she's beautiful. And when I say statuesque, I mean like almost literally, right? You know, how many statues of Athena and that position she takes and, you know, how strong she is, all that. So Angelina Jolie is perfectly cast for a role like that. And the costuming and all really accentuates the way in which she's beautiful and strong and, you know, you don't want to go up against her. She's an elite warrior, if you will. However, this is the mixed blessing part of it. She looks ideal for the role. She knows how to strike a pose and hold it. But she almost did seem frozen at times. In other words, and this is something more in the script than in the performance. I don't think as a character, if we can think of mythological characters this way, I don't think there was enough substance to it. I don't think it was sufficiently three-dimensional, if I can put it that way. It just oftentimes seemed like in a scene, she was striking a dramatic pose and saying a sentence or two, and then that's it. I mean, what do you think of that, Marie? Because I think she sort of got trapped because of the script. There was only so much she could do with that part. What do you think?
I agree with you completely. And I think where it worked, where she worked, was where you thought to yourself, not Athena, but Maleficent, you know, the sort of strong mythological creature, you know, used to have wings, you know, just all of that completely plausible in that Disney world, but it also kind of transferred over here just because you know her from that. And the last point I'll make about this movie is, even though we disagree about whether to see it, I will say this is definitely going to win some special effects awards.
Well, it has to, really. I mean, it's such a big picture, and on technical grounds, it is impressive. In fact, I had so much time to think about it because, like Marie, I sat through the end credits because, you know, with a Marvel film, you got to stay through the end credits. And you'll notice in the audience, very few people leave. They're all there for it. And okay, immediately when the film ends, you get the first of what Marie said before you get the first one. But you know better than to say, oh, that's it, and walk out, because then at the very, very end. But the reason I mention that at this moment is I looked at and I read the names, I think, or glossed over the names of hundreds of technicians who worked on the special effects. So not only had I appreciated them as I was watching them, but I now could appreciate all the people who made them. And Marie, those credit rolls go on, as you know, for like 10 minutes or more. Mm-hmm. And you're right, Marie, like joking aside here, it's asking a lot of an audience to sit there for another 10 minutes for what's going to amount to like a 20-second punchline at the very end of the film. But you need to if you're hooked on the franchise, because it does come at the very end. But just be prepared to have a lot of scrolling, a lot of names going by. And I don't even know what half these people did. Like, I understand some of the basics of special effects, but Marie, let me give you the last word on this, because there are some like categories like, you know, this and that and special effects. And some of them think, well, what is that? And they have 25 people doing that, whatever that is. Do you ever have that response where like you understand some of the special effects and they'll have some unit listed? And I'm thinking, but what would that even be?
Well, and then they got to show you the second unit, and then they've got to show you the whole gamut of people who did all of those things in the Canary Islands when they were filming there. So yes, it does go on forever. But I do think this is going to be hard to beat in special effects. And I think it put Dune to shame in terms of that. Go see this in 3D if you're going to see it. So our next movie is Spencer, which is about a period of time in the story of Diana Spencer, the Princess of Wales, specifically this one Christmas where she has had enough of the way things have been and she fights back. And we get a chance to see her with, it's almost a relentlessly doom-filled sense of her life because, you know, constant oboes and foreboding music, almost no moments of lightness. But I think we probably need to talk about Kristen Stewart in the lead role, but I'm going to give it to you, Mike, to see if there's anything else you want to do in terms of setting the table here.
Yeah, speaking of setting the table, this is a dysfunctional family that gets together for Christmas. The family just happens to be the royal family, if you will. And what's interesting there is how it really, and what I did like about the film was the sense of detail. And speaking of the family dinner table, you know, the house staff or the palace staff, as people are working in the kitchen, setting the table, how the family gathers. And the family in this case, of course, refers to itself or has been referred to as the firm. When you marry into or join the royal family, it's a business group. What struck me as quite interesting, among other things, was that even though Queen Elizabeth II, on the one hand, is very familiar to us, having been the monarch for so many decades, on the other hand, she remains a remote figure. What's interesting here within the family circle is how remote and distant she can seem even within that family circle. She's the queen to them. They're deferring to her and saying, Your Highness, and so on. And, you know, the actor playing her only has a few lines of dialogue even. And so when Diana, this relatively independent, free spirit, comes into the household, there is a sense of doom. You know that, you know, her marriage to Charles is troubled. He's already having his affair with Camilla. You know that the stress, the strain of trying to fit into a family that for the most part doesn't want her and doesn't know what to do with her. But the only other thing I'll say at the moment by way of setting the stage is, number one, that's an interesting premise. It works well in the film. Number two, Kristen Stewart is very, very good in this role. I mean, she really is well cast as Diana. And the camera is often placed slightly low looking up to emphasize that kind of stature that Diana had, that kind of presence. It makes Kristen Stewart look bigger than she actually is. You know, it gives her that kind of formidable, and I don't mean that in an intimidating way, but simply a formidable presence, a personality, if you will, in her own right. But the final thing I really wanted to say before turning it back to you is that the director of this film is Pablo Larraín. And Pablo Larraín is Chilean. And I teach a course on Latin American film history, and I show one of his dramas, No, which is one of his political dramas made in Chile. And what's interesting is he's kind of segued a bit into more mainstream, more commercial filmmaking. The film I'll mention very quickly that ties in very directly to this one is one of his more recent films, Larraín's film Jackie, which is about Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Because these are women who are in the public spotlight and how unforgiving that can be. There are shots in this film, Spencer, where Diana just wants to walk with her two boys, you know, across the lawn or down a street or something, but the paparazzi, and this is of course many years before the fatal accident, but the paparazzi are relentless. The moment she hits the street, there are dozens of flashbulbs going off and people in her face, and you know, how do you have a life of your own? And even though I said that would be the final observation, I'll tack on an addendum. Charles himself, even though they have a strained marriage, Charles is sympathetic in the sense of saying to her at one point, and it's a good line in the script, he says, you need to have like two personalities. You need like the public face, the smile you put on your face as you pose for those photographers, and then whatever your private self is. And that's one of the things that Diana just can't reconcile. She can't bring herself to this. And there's a lot of mental stress there, and certainly marital stress, but within herself. And let me hand it back to you now, because I actually had ultimately mixed, even negative feelings about the film, but those are all things I liked about the film. So on that positive note, I'll hand it back to you.
I agree with you. I think Kristen Stewart is amazing in this, and it's all in the eyes. It's all the way she's clearly studied Diana Spencer to get her down cold. And what she gets right is that shy die thing that we remember from the 80s, the clothes are amazing. This is certainly a contender for a costuming sort of nomination, if not an award, because it gives you that sense of her being a Barbie doll. And the, you know, the behind the scenes stuff, you know, if you're a fan of The Crown, the kind of thing where you find out about this, you know, antique weighing thing that you have to sit on so they can see how much you weigh before the big meal, and then they're going to weigh you afterwards, and the constant wardrobe changes. You know, there's something you wear for breakfast, and then you go change, you know, there's a costume change for lunch, and there's certainly one for dinner, there's one for church, and it's not like you get to pick them, they are chosen for you. And that adds to this whole like Barbie doll idea. And one of the things I thought was really well done was the sort of foreshadowing of what happened with Harry and Meghan, because the movie does a good job, I think, of showing how, in spite of all of her problems, which were, she had plenty of problems, she was clearly very unhappy in that house and really wanted to escape. And when she's playing with her kids, who she clearly adores, there's one moment where, you know, they're say something to William, young William, about, you know, do you want to become the king? And he says, well, I don't really have a choice. And it struck me watching that how what a foreshadowing that was, because Harry did have a choice, and you could see why he would break from the royal family when he did, because of what you see unfolding in this movie, this inability to do anything or say anything, to be watched all the time, and to move throughout this castle, which sounds like an ideal existence, like a spy, you know, hoping nobody's going to notice everything you do in the house, and that the paparazzi outside are going to photograph you, you know, having a breakdown, because you literally are never not watched. I thought they did a brilliant job of doing that. And I thought Kristen Stewart really, really got that across, that sense of loneliness. Even with all the servants, even with her children, no matter where she was alone.
Maria, I agree with you on all those points. Where I liked the film less was, and a reminder that the director himself knows he's making a biopic, but Pablo Larraín has said that, and this is a direct quote from the director, Pablo Larraín, he describes the film as a fable from a true tragedy. Now, it's where he starts to fictionalize in the fabular aspect of it, the fable aspect. I like the film less. For instance, with her troubled mental state, she starts to imagine that she sees Anne Boleyn, one of Henry VIII's wives. The script by Stephen Knight is very heavy-handed in that respect. There are places where it kind of clubs. Foreshadowing is fine, but this is like foreshadowing with a club, if you will, over the head. And there are times where I think the film is just a little too literal-minded that way and a little too blunt. And that's where I liked the film less as it went along, because I thought, you know, everything we've been saying about it that you just said, Maria, I agree strongly with, but we don't need then to have Anne Boleyn in period costume actually walking down a hallway as Diana watches her or fantasizes it. And to see that multiple times, it's like thematically, I get it. It's just too heavy handed at that point.
I agree with you completely. The two things that I thought made the wheels come off this movie for me was Sally Hawkins' character, who, and I love her. And in the beginning of the movie, I'd liked the character, but I thought it went off into a really strange side street. The other thing was that they make a point of pointing out that Diana grew up in a house not too far from the grounds from where she is at the moment. And so she wants to literally go home again and sets off to try to gain access to her old house. Now, this is where I'm thinking, wait a minute, is this something for real? Because it's this huge estate you see in flashbacks. It was once quite grand. It's now, you know, this condemned building kind of thing. You shouldn't go in it. It's not safe. You know, you fall through the stairs, all that kind of thing. But I'm thinking, really? When you think about all of the fuss they made over Diana, I can't believe that that house wouldn't have just been overrun with people making off with the, you know, whatever thing they could pry out of the house in terms of the wood and literally any piece of that house. I just cannot imagine it standing empty like that. To me, that was so unbelievable to almost ruin the movie, except as sort of a fairy tale aside.
Maria, again, that's where the fable is so overstated and so heavy-handed. And on a realistic level, there's scenes where she wanders off like that to visit her childhood estate, or where she wants to go off with the children. Where is the security force? I mean, it's a point mentioned in the film, but this is where it's implausible. There are scenes where she goes wandering off like that. There's no way in the world that they would let her go wandering off like that alone, much less when she has two heirs to the throne with her. There would not be a security detail following. You know what I mean, Marie? This is where the film overstates its case with her wanting to break away. And it works only as a fable at that point. It's just losing its connection to reality. It's too much the overstated fable. It's just too heavy-handed.
I agree. So mixed blessings in this movie, but Kristen Stewart, at least for the nomination for Best Actress for this. Which brings us to the end of our episode. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. You can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.